Accession number 33891.
Real 11.
Gary Garrett's Real 11.
Right, we've arrived at Marham. Rather amazing way things happen. All people who had been arriving over a period of a week or so, I gather, and we were all told to assemble in the conference room or whatever it was, a lecture room. And there was all, well, you can imagine, every Washington had 9 crew. And the place was packed tight. The wing commander flying got up and said, right, gentlemen, he said, many of you know each other, because a lot of them were ex-bomber command, had been. Some of you don't, so what we'd like you to do, well, we now announce who are to be captain of aircraft, and you, those individuals can go around and pick the crew that they want to fly with. Well, I knew nobody, so I just sat there and took what was left. And I finished up with 2 flight lieutenants. One became the squadron signals officer. Was it 3? Sorry, one became the squadron gunnery officer, and the other was a flight lieutenant navigator. Excuse me. And here I must stop and tell a story about this man. His name was Zeleny, Adolf Zeleny, a Czech. When the Germans had come into Czechoslovakia, he'd been in the Czech army. He escaped. I never really discovered what his rank was, but it was fairly senior. Excuse me again. He escaped by talking 2 train drivers into hiding him in the tender where all the coal was. They made an arch, and he lay in there. And they took him out to France, got him across to France. And there he joined the French Foreign Legion. If you join the French Foreign Legion then, and I believe now, and do 5 years, you can claim French nationality. And I understand at the end of the war a lot of Germans tried it. So he, because of his experience, made a warrant officer in the French Foreign Legion, and his task, as he had explained it, was to escort camel trains across the desert to the various forts to supply them with replacements, money, and young ladies. A caravan was pulled in. He said, more often than not, the money we handed over came back to the with girls. Anyway, came then the French, the German war starting. He was recalled to France to join the Czech army, Free Czech Army, I think it was called. Dunkirk, he walked out across France, over the Pyrenees, got into Lisbon, where he managed to get a lift on a British ship, got to UK, and as he put it, no more bloody walking for me, I'm joining the Air Force. Went into Bomber Command, became a flight lieutenant, and went home when the war ended as a flight lieutenant navigator. But when he got home to Czechoslovakia, he was ostracised because he'd been an officer in the British forces. He had nothing to go to live to. But he'd taken with him his wife and 2 children. So he once again made a few plans. He sent his wife and 2 children back because they were on British passports. They could be stopped. And then he organised that he had to do an educational trip somewhere along the line. I don't quite know how he managed this, but he got out of Czechoslovakia, got to Germany and to the British zone, got back to the UK where he rejoined the Air Force, and at that point rejoined Bomber Command as my navigator. When all things ended, his last job was as a squadron leader based in El Adam, Tobruk, as officer in charge of desert rescue training. So he did a full circle. And he picked up an MP along the line.
So you said there was 9 crewmen on the
line? 9 crew, yes.
Yeah, what did they all do?
Well, you had pilot, navigator, a set co-pilot, and a signaller up front. That was 4. Down back, and I'll explain how you get to the back in a minute, was a radar controller and all the scanners, as the American called them. 4. That what they were all remote, all the guns were remotely controlled. There were turrets, but the guns were actually controlled from a sitting position where you could look out. And so you had four guns. And incidentally, the B-29 had five engines, not four. Because also in the back was a Volkswagen-size engine, which you started up, which gave you the power to start the engines. We used to call it the putt-putt. Putt-putt on or putt-putt off. So, yes, you had nine. To get to the back, it's quite interesting, there was a tunnel that ran behind. If you can picture the remote gun turret, the main part of it was inside the fuselage, just by where we were sitting, in fact. So you went round the back, it climbed up a step and got into the tunnel, and you crawled all the way through to go to the toilet, which was at the back. And the Americans, in their way, when they were giving us training exit pictures, showed us what would happen to you if you're at one end and the compression went at the other. And you went down it, they had a body in it, and they did it, pulled the plug, so all the air went out, and the body shot down like a bullet and hit the other end and smashed to pieces. So you were a bit scared about going to the loo. With the B-52, incidentally, later on, same thing happened, only you were on a trolley and you pulled yourself through on a cord. Anyway, we did our conversion course, then the squadron moved to Coningsby, and there, really, we were just sort of doing cross-country exercises. The biggest bomb I carried was a 25-pounder, and it could have carried 40 500-pound bombs and 6,500 gallons of petrol. That's what the B-29 could do. Best, longest trip I ever did was to take off from Coningsby, fly to Malta, and just out beyond Malta there is a rock which is, had been used as a bombing site, dropped a single 25-pound bomb on it, turned around and flew all the way back, 16 hours, to drop a 25-pound bomb. And that's all we did, just... We were there as a deterrent. Apparently, if thing happened, we could have been loaded up. I never carried anything more than a 25-pound bomb.
Was it a stopgap aircraft in between the British V bombers?
Yes, it was. The Lancaster. No, not the V bomber. The Lancasters were getting old, and they were, you know, they'd done their time. The Canberras were the next in line, and they weren't rolling off the lines fast enough to form squadrons. So the Americans had lent the British enough B-29s, I think it was, to make eight squadrons up, four at Coningsby and four at Marham. And the conversion unit was at Marham until the last one was done. And I had an interesting station commander for a little while, Gus Walker, Group Captain Gus Walker, who lost one arm. And I had the honour of taking him up for his first trip in a B-29. It's quite an amazing man, where he had a little clamp that went onto the four throttles and used that to open and close the throttles. I'm not quite sure what he would have done if it was shut one down, you know, in emergency, but no, he's quite a chap. And he used to play golf regularly on the local thing to Woodhall Spa.
How did the B-29 handle? As it gets very large, very nice
aircraft. The first aircraft that you could officially smoke in, because the Americans... ashtrays or other place. Another interesting thing about it, which I personally never used, but in various places, one above the pilot's head, was a thing, something like an open beaker, which plugged in and got hot. So if you were issued rations, shall we say, of tin food, you opened the tin, dropped it in and turned on it, heated it for you. I mean, the Americans like their comfort, why not? But... The unusual thing about the B-29, from my point of view, was the way the bomb aimer operated. Now, Selany was my navigator, but he was also the bomb aimer. And with the bomb, you can imagine in the old Lancaster, the chap up front, left or right, left, right, left, right. Not so with the bomb, with B-29. When you went down and you turned on the bomb sight, you threw a switch, and he controlled the aircraft for left and right turns. The pilot held the helmet, but as the bomb aimer moved the sights to keep the target on, he made the alterations of the aircraft to keep it on the target. It's quite interesting. Yes. And of course, one of the things about the B-29 too, like the Dakota, it had a turret for star shots. In fact, Zeleny was a brilliant man. He invented and patented a star shooter which did two at once. So you didn't have to waste your time calculating, it shows your position. And the Americans bought it.
And with the B-29, I take it that you had quite good vision ahead of you, did you? With it?
Oh, you had a very good vision ahead of you. It was dolly to fly. I'll give you a good example of what a dolly it was. We had a request from the Army. Bomber Khan had a request from the Army, which got down to the squadron, and as usual, things passed down to the next in line to fly. And a chap called Ray Corney and myself, as the two captains, were told to fly to Anglesey and fly in formation, and we must keep 100 feet apart all the time. And on the ground, the Army would have radar guns, because they were having problems with the guns, as we had with the mosquitoes on target time, where the guns started following the wire cable. The guns were flicking when there were too many aircraft, and they wanted to do some tests. So I think Ray said, well, how do we maintain 100? Oh, it's all right, then we've obtained two naval gun sights which record distances, and you will have one each. And so we tossed a coin to see who was going to be leader and who was going to form, and I got the job of formating. And I tell you, it was not difficult. One of the scanners sat on his, and he had this thing pinned onto a point on the aircraft, which was at the 100 feet point, and he just kept in, 99, 98, 97. So I just made slight alterations. And on the other side, one Corney's Ray's aircraft, they also had one, and they were keeping a check. So as long as he kept steady, I kept it. The only trouble, of course, when we got to an end of run and turning and coming back, getting into position. But it was an easy aircraft to fly, it really was. And that's a good example of how easy it was.
And you did a lot of cross-country work with them?
Oh, a lot of cross-country work, but and a lot of dropping bombs on targets in off Norfolk, I think it was, that somewhere around there was a little bomb site built up. We used to go and drop these 25-pound bombs on, and they would be marked for us. So we'd get scores, we'd take photos and that sort of thing. But it was a job that had to be done. And then again, the squadron began to break up. And where did I go next? Oh, from there I went, oh yes, to Tongeren. Yes, this life gets better. At Silt, on the north coast of Schleswig-Holstein, it's a little island. And there, all the fighter squadrons from Germany would go for, I think it was a three-week summer camp, to do air-to-air firing. The only place they could do it was out over the sea. And there were aircraft, I think they were Mustangs, but I can't remember what the pilots flew, with the targets on the back. As I understand it, most of the pilots who did the towing were pilots who had flown into the targets previously rather than hitting it with a gun or had done something stupid. I'm told whether or not that's true. And I was told I was to be detachment commander of RAF Schleswigland, which was on the other side of the peninsula, where we were to have mosquitoes target towing. And these were targets, though, for the army to fire at on the Baltic coast. And they too came up for a summer camp. And we used to, I wasn't required to do much flying, I was the detachment commander. But I had four pilots, and complete ground. When I arrived, the Norwegian army would hold the place. The Norwegian army and the Danish army had helped the British army of occupation by Schleswig-Holstein. And they slowly disappeared. And an interesting thing here, you remember I was talking about the airlift, how there were some flight refueling aircraft came from Schleswigland. Well, they were refueled from tanks that had been put upon a high mound. You can imagine a mound about, I would imagine, 7 or 8 feet high, then on top of the tanks. And the aircraft would taxi alongside and the pipe would lead from these, and it was just a gravity feed. And when I arrived, the Norwegians were leaving and they were taking these tanks to pieces. And I didn't ask questions, but all the tanks that had been used during the airlift were removed by the Norwegian, taken home. Whether they built them up when they got there, I don't know. And the last thing about the Norwegians, though, when they left, they had a parade, and Crown Prince Olaf came to take the parade, and there was a march past, and at the point the Danish flag was supposed to, the Norwegian flag, I'm sorry, was supposed to be lowered, it stuck, and the Crown Prince put his hand in his pocket, stepped forward, opened a knife, slashed the rope, and down came the flag. Royalty at its best. But it was, that was quite interesting the way they actually departed, and I got, as you notice on the stairs going down, those odd shields I was presented with by the Norwegians and the Danes for assistance received. But the target time was boring. It was, you know, for the pilots who had to do it. And we had problem, because what happened when underneath the Mosquito was a winch, and attached to the winch was a cable that fed out, and the captain, that was the drogue. And the inside the drogue operator, who was sat alongside the pilot, threw a switch, and this dropped the drogue at the same time as the winch started. But we found that in many cases it was coming apart. So we overcame that problem by additional cable joining. And then we started doing these trips. The next thing, we got a complaint, well, not a complaint, but a comment from the army. We'd better do something about this, because we're finding the radar guns, which are actually firing ammunition at these drogues, are picking up the cable and are creeping up the cable towards the aircraft, and we've had to stop firing. So I got onto the silt, and we was discuffed. And I believe there was target towing going on somewhere in England for the Navy, for the same thing. And their solution had been to attach a 100-yard strip of cord, nylon cord, as the first part, so the radar gun couldn't jump across. And that was it. Quite often the drogues would blow out. I got told off for not flying enough, and was forced to take an instrument rating test. And that went on for, well, a couple of years.
Did you fly the Mosquito?
I was. One of the four that was on the station was a QFI, and he checked me out, and then later on he had the orders of the Wing Commander flying, who was a very nice type. In fact, he's my son's godfather, who was born in Schleswig Glen. He insisted I did my instrument rating, and I got a comment back from the Wing Commander that he said, I understand from Organ, his name was Organ, that you couldn't stop singing all the time you were doing it, and I said, no, I've been doing that. You did a certain amount of, you know, I think I explained these loops, not loops, these circles and climbs and then. But
what were your impressions of the Mosquitoes and aircraft?
A lovely little aircraft. Again, we could do aerobatics with it because of this plecarouille thing underneath. And it was a good aircraft for one engine. It was an occasional thing to stop an engine on takeoff, do a practice landing on single engine. We had a farmer who used all the grassland and used it for pasture, grew wheat and things like that, which is typical in England. A lot of that happened. Only I found out one day doing a tour of the camp that he was charging up his battery for his tractor from one of our sheds. And when I reprimanded him, I was terribly sorry. And when I got home that evening, a hunk of venison had been delivered, which was rather fortunate because the Navy was arriving that weekend. The Baltic Fleet, I think they called themselves, I think it was four motor torpedo boats. And they'd come down the Baltic, right down the Schlei to Schleswig Land at the bottom, and I had to entertain the officers. So we had venison. It helped.
So where were you posted to after your...
Well, one little thing I must tell you, one more point about Schleswig. Because I was the commandant, I was, shall we say, well-treated for staff. We had a housemaid, a children's maid, and a gardener come generally operator, a stoker, looked after the... And he had been an officer on the submarine. That was one of the reparations way of paying. And he taught me, came to me once when I was doing something, he said, here, Commandant, you waste so much time, I must tell you, half an hour's think, no, 5 minutes think saves half an hour work. and I found that a very good motto. But there's one other little story that I must tell you. There were no British consuls as such. The local man was a Brigadier Vickery, and he was called the British resident. He was a senior man for the area. And we used to have him for a meal, because he was on his own. Occasionally his wife would arrive from UK where they ran a farm, I think, and then we'd go there occasionally. And we were at his home when he said, I must listen to the radio, and this was when the war was going on against the Chinese. The Norfolk Regiment, wasn't it? And Speakman, who won a VC.
Korea.
And Speakman won the VC, and he was listening to him. And I looked at this man, and tears were rolling down his eyes. I said, excuse me, Brigadier, are you all right? He said, yes, this is my regiment. And these are my boys doing this. And this was a chap who, during the 1418 war, had earned 3 military crosses. And he was crying about his men. Now, from there we went on. Now, here's the interesting thing. By now I was a flight lieutenant. And I was posted to a school for officers' training. Now, I'd been commissioned in 1946. And it was now, 53s, 54s. For the first time, I went to school to learn about being an officer. At the end of which, I was posted to Cranwell as the station adjutant. And I have to be clear, it's station adjutant. That's the administrative wing, or the administrative organisation for Cranwell. There was another adjutant, the college adjutant. And he was the adjutant to the commandant of the college, who was an air commodore, where I was adjutant to the station commander, who was a group captain. And in that capacity, I was responsible for discipline, and generally discipline. I mean, it was my advice to the station commander whether he could deal with the charge or whether it should be recommended for a court-martial. I never recommended anybody for a court-martial. In fact, in the whole of my service career, I never put anybody on a charge, but that's neither here nor there.
So the station adjutant, basically, you're essentially running the whole the station.
You're the PA to the station commander.
But you do, I take it, most of the.
It depends. I think I started with a group captain who liked to be in control, and the next one was a wing commander who said, "Well, can you organise this or do this?" That. No, you're not really in charge, man. You are the senior disciplinarian on the station. That's the main thing. And when there's a parade, it's your problem to get the parade organised properly. And it was on this, here though, that I flew a jet for the first time. In those days, pilots who were on ground jobs were supposed to do 50 hours flying a year to keep their flying pay. And it couldn't be done during term time because the cadets were using the aircraft full time. But after term time, the cadets were away, but the air crew instructors only had their periods of leave. They would then take over and look after the people like my air crew, normal flying. And at the end of our particular course, there was awards given to the best pilot in the train, and I was given an award, and it has appeared as a lavatory train on a little board, and it was presented to me as being the only pilot on the course who could transmit aileron flutter through from the control column. So I said, what? Well, he said, you were a bit nervous, weren't you? Well, I had to point out that at that time, I'd got my wings in 42. We're now into 53, and I hadn't been upside down since. I'd done no aerobatic in all that time. It's all heavies. So it was the first time I'd done aerobatics, and especially in a jet. So, yes, I was a bit nervous.
What jet had you done your... What jet had you been in?
Oh, that only one, the Vampire. That was the first one I flew. So, because you were adjutant, postings for officers usually came to you to pass on from Air Ministry. And I had a phone call after a couple of years, during which time my promotion came to squadron leader. And I was then talked about my career, and I could see these cadets over the other side passing out as pilot officers automatic flying officers could guarantee be squadron leaders by the time we're 30 if they get their cut. Well, they're about, here as I, coming to up to the, well, I was getting on, 39 I think, just made squadron leaders, not a hope of me going further. So I opted not to serve till age 55, but to come out at age 49, which was one of the officers. I thought then it would be better because I've got a better chance of getting a job. So anyway, I was a squad leader and I took a phone call from Air Ministry and they said, we've got a posting for you if you wanted. So I said, yes. He said, we want somebody to go out to Cyprus and take over the Middle East Comm Squadron. Are you interested? So I said, yeah. And the chap said, are you sure? I said, well, yes, of course I'm sure. And he said, yes, otherwise. He said, good God. He said, you're the ninth one we've asked and you're the first to say yes. Well, that was no compliment to start with. So I said, well, why are the others getting out of it? He said, well, pregnancies, children's education, elderly parents coming up to the end of their... Oh, I said, right, well, no, I'm all right. So he said, well, you report into Southampton 10 days' time and you'll be sailing to Cyprus. So I said, I will. He said, yes, with family, because you're an ex, you get an ex officio married quarter. But in the meantime... Because your squadron has got meteors on it and you've never flown a meteor, you've got to go to Worksop and do a week's course on meteors. So I left my wife and two kids to pack up, prepare everything to go overseas while I went off to Worksop to learn to fly meteors. And then we got to the boat, sailed out to Malta. And when I got on the boat, I found I was the senior RAF officer, so I was officer IC troops, or IOC the RAF. And then when we got to Cyprus, got off, and everybody been reporting to a, I think he was called senior quartermaster, who was told, no, that's your bus, you're going to so-and-so, that's your bus. And I walked up and said, I'm off to Akrotiri, I've got an ex-officio. He said, no, you haven't, sir. I said, I'm told I've got an ex-officio quarter. He said, you're not on the list. So off he went, made a phone call. He said, no, sir. He said, you've got to wait to go on a waiting list for married quarter. So there was I, standing on the quayside in Cyprus, having been told I was getting moving safe into a house by Air Ministry, and nowhere. Two children, one aged four, one aged six. So I said, now what? He said, well, fortunately, we always have a few men, people here, local Cypriots from Limassol, who have homes that they are trying to rent out to the British forces. There were... a couple who had come out knowing that they were going to take on. He said, there are two or three left. Would you like to talk to one of them? So we moved into a house in Limassol.